Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University as part of the 200th anniversary of the ending of the U.S. Atlantic slave trade. Speaking will be UCLA history professor Gary Nash. Professor Nash's lecture is titled Agrippa Hull, New Perspectives on a Berkshire Revolutionary Patriot. We begin with an introduction by Ronald Richardson, director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University. Professor Richardson.
We as a country and as a culture suffer from a collective amnesia. It is like a disease of the brain, of the memory. This syndrome has less of an effect on the African American community because the memory of slavery and the slave trade is a living memory. I remember as a boy stories my mother would tell us from her father and from his father and grandmother. They were from Virginia, from the Petersburg area, about slavery and about slavery times and about Jim Crow. My mother died in 2002 and 92, and her father was born in 1863 in Petersburg, Virginia. In other words, he was born 2 years before the constitutional amendment that abolished slavery in the United States. And he vividly remembered the Jim Crow era, lived through it, called himself a race man. So this is a living memory in the African-American community, but it is a memory in danger of perishing forever within the broader American community. Witness the fact that 200 years after the abolition of the slave trade, there are very few public events occurring in the United States, even at Boston University. I think this is the only event at Boston University, and you see how well subscribed and attended this event is. Professor Gary Nash is professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he's taught from 1968. Professor Nash has also been the director of the National Center for History in the Schools since 1994. As the director of the National Center for History in the Schools, he oversaw the publication of over 60 teaching units on specific issues and dramatic events in United States and world history, designed for grades 5 through 12. From 1992 to 1996, Professor Nash co-chaired the National History Standards Project, which landed him in the middle of ideological debates about how history should be taught to young people whose history should be taught and the merits of multiculturalism in the classroom. His first book, Quakers and Politics, Pennsylvania, 1681 to 1726, was published in 1968, won a prize from the American Historical Association. In 1988, his Forging Freedom, the Formation of Philadelphia's Black Community, 1720 to 1840, won the prize for the best book from the Society of the History of the Early American Republic. His other entitles include well-known Red, White, and Black, The Peoples of Early America, The Private Side of American History, and The Unknown American Revolution, I believe, right? Which I read last summer, and it is a book which tries to resurrect those forgotten people, those forgotten patriots, and the notion, radical notion of democracy, which sometimes is lost in American history courses. His most recent book is entitled Friends of Liberty, Thomas Jefferson, Thaddeus Kosciuszko, and Agrippa Hull, A Tale of Three Patriots, Two Revolutions, and a Tragic Betrayal of Freedom in the New Nation. He will lecture today on Agrippa Hull, New Perspectives on a Berkshire Revolutionary Patriot. Please join with me in welcoming Professor Gary Nash.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, and this is an exercise in trying to help us recover from this disease of historical amnesia. My agenda today, to put it right out in front of you, is to enlist your sympathies and your support in creating a little elbow room in the pantheon of founding fathers of the Revolutionary era. We have something new. It's called Founder Chic these days, with a wave of biographies of the familiar founding fathers, all white, all male, of course. And I'm not trying to knock them off their marble pedestals or evict them from the pantheon. I'm just trying to create a little more room for additional pedestals in a somewhat more capacious pantheon. And this would oblige us to pay attention to some people in the struggles for revolutionary freedom who in certain ways, some not so easy to notice, did more to make operational the founding principles of the revolution than the founding fathers that we revere in our textbooks. Okay, and now the theme that I try to weave through this talk has to do with agencies. Agency, and I mean by agency, acts of individuals to make things happen, change, to bring about change. Sometimes we're talking about an army of one, a single individual who's marching alone by himself. And the kind of agency I want to talk about today is not that of a person who wields a gleaming sword or a fiery pen. It's rather a kind of silent agency or semi-programmatic agency, which nonetheless, in certain cases, has had great effects. And this brings us then to the person that I've been studying, Agrippa Hull. He was born in Northampton, Massachusetts in 1759. He did not have a sunny upbringing, though he was born free. His father died when he was 2, probably fighting in the Seven Years' War. And his mother, with 4 children, had to leave Northampton, like so many others who lost a bit of land, which they had, and headed farther west and farmed out Agrippa to a free black man in Stockbridge. But Agrippa's parents had worshipped in Jonathan Edwards' church. And so he grew up in a part of Massachusetts where the racial lines were more fluid than in most places in North America. From one of the sermons of Reverend Edwards, we hear these words: "We are made of the same human race. Their master made them alike with the same nature, master and slave." And so Agrippa was baptized in a Northampton church that Edwards had ministered. Growing up in Stockbridge, Hull had some advantages: a multicultural society where Stockbridge Indians were represented on the city council as much as whites, and where some young Stockbridge Indian students went to Dartmouth. At any rate, when the war broke out, Agrippa Hull enlisted at age 18 in the Revolutionary Army. We have in the muster list the following terse description: Agrippa Hull, stature, 5 feet 7 inches, complexion, black, hair, wool, end of description. He was assigned immediately as an orderly to Colonel John Patterson, came from Lenox, Massachusetts, near Stockbridge, already a hardened leader with several years of war behind him and known for recruiting Stockbridge Indians for his regiment. And under new orders, Patterson, with Agrippa Hull trailing him, hastened to defend Ticonderoga. There, Hull joined him as messenger, attendant, valet, what was called an orderly in the 18th century Revolutionary Army. And it was here, while serving at an officer's table at Fort Ticonderoga in May 1777, that Agrippa Hull met a man who would figure importantly in the rest of his life. And this was Thaddeus, well, we say Kosciuszko in this country, but the Poles I now know pronounce it Kosciuszko. So I'll call it Kosciuszko. Kosciuszko was born into modern, modest Polish gentry family in eastern Poland, and this is the house. He was trained in France as a military engineer. He imbibed some anti-slavery ideas, studying in Paris from Rousseau and other Enlightenment figures, and then he had crossed the Atlantic to fight with the Americans. And after he proved himself as a valuable military engineer, he was sent to Ticonderoga, and there he played an important role in the American victory over Burgoyne's British troops at Bemis Heights and at Saratoga. And there you'll find not a statue of Agrippa Hull, but one of Kosciuszko. Hull was there. He remembered it in applying for a pension many years later. "I was there when Burgoyne ran up the white flag. And from that point on, when Hull was reassigned as an orderly from Patterson's regiment to Kosciuszko, he served every year of the remainder of the war for 4 years and 2 months, side by side with this Polish military engineer still learning English here, side by side, in a time when there were no Christmas furloughs or leaves, in daily contact. Now, under Army protocol, social distance was an important part of how officers maintained discipline among men. One could be court-martialed for fraternization with enlisted men, but that was not the case with staff officers, and particularly with someone assigned to you as an orderly. The relationship was very close. Close contact, and out of it, there came between Kosciuszko and Hull a special bond that influenced both of them. Now, one colorful instance discloses this special dynamic that began early in this military relationship. It's recounted in the local records that Kosciuszko had made Grippy his confidential and head servant and entrusted him with his wardrobe. And when they went together to West Point, where Kosciuszko was in charge of building the fortifications, which would block British passage up the Hudson River to Albany, here, one day when Kosciuszko was away reconnoitering downriver, Hull called together all the other black soldiers in the camp for a festive dinner. Befitting the son of an African prince, he donned Kosciuszko's spectacular Polish uniform. Resplendent, these are the words in the record, with a crown-shaped cap and a showy cluster of nodding ostrich plumes, unquote. Lacking officer's boots, Agrippa Hull blacked up his legs to shine like polished leather. And then the wine was served, and hilarity broke out among the blacklisted men. Now this, looking at it from a historian's point of view today, was a kind of role reversal incident, very reminiscent of the New England Election Day ceremonies where free black people would be king for a day, and with the consent of white people. It was a kind of safety valve, a relief from slavery and demeaned free black life. And this is what seemed to happen. Now, unfortunately, Kosciuszko returned from what was supposed to be a two-day reconnoitering down the Hudson River. He had difficulty getting across the river and came back into the camp to witness this festive occasion. John Patterson's great-grandson, Patterson was Agrippa Hull's first officer, writing a century ago, related, "General Kosciuszko suddenly sprang in among them, causing such commotion that if Satan himself had appeared in their midst, it could not have resulted in a greater stampede. Mortified, Grippy," he became known as Grippy Hull, "fell prostrate at the general's feet, crying, 'Kill me, massa, do anything to me, Mr. General.'" And Kosciuszko then said, with great formality, as the record tells us, clasped Grippy's hand and said, "Rise, prince. It is beneath the dignity of an African prince to prostrate himself at the feet of anyone," unquote. And then he escorted Hull to his quarters and had him continue the game of role reversal by sitting on a kind of crude throne, and then they smoked the pipe together. Now, this could have been the end of a brief officer-enlisted man relationship. Instead, it was the beginning of an enduring emotional relationship. There was something in Kosciuszko, some understanding of the humanity of this young black man, some sense of his value and his virtue that made him turn this into an occasion where Agrippa Hull could be rescued from humiliation and instead launched on a continuing relationship during the war. And that, I think, is where Kosciusko's admiration for black Americans grew as the war grew on. Also, the black men who helped to build the fortifications at West Point. And so it came in August 1780 that Kosciusko was sent south to become the military engineer of George Washington's Southern Army, and with him went Grippy Hull. Grippy, he reported, was the only orderly, quote, willing to go with me so far off, unquote. This testified to the bond that had grown between the two men, as well as the reluctance of most New Englanders to fight so far from home. So reaching North Carolina in October 1780, and can you see the red line I've inscribed on this map coming down from West Point, which is the just above the top green dot? This red line that continues down through Virginia and into North Carolina. The black line is the route of Cornwallis over 3 years of the Southern Campaign. And I've imposed over it a red line tracing the Kosciusko-Hull journeys of over 5,000 miles in the last 3 years of the war in the South. So down they came through Virginia, stopping in Richmond, and where they apparently met the wartime governor of Virginia, none other than Thomas Jefferson, and then on to Hillsborough, North Carolina, where Hull and Kosciusko met up with General Nathanael Greene, Washington's Southern Army leader. What they found there were remnants of a Revolutionary Army. Here is what Nathanael Greene wrote Washington. This is one of many letters. The miserable situation of the troops for want of clothing has rendered our marches the most painful imaginable, several hundreds of the soldiers tracking the ground with their bloody feet, unquote. It's almost impossible for us today, accustomed to stories about body armor and sophisticated motorized vehicles, almost impossible to comprehend how such a shoeless, shirtless, breechless, payless, and nearly starved army continued to fight. But they did fight. And with Agrippa Hull at his side, Kosciusko now became the advance man for Greene's heroic attempts to build a demoralized and undermanned army, while harrying the much superior British forces as they moved northward through North Carolina for what they hoped would be a killing strike against Virginia that would end the long war. Through the winter of 1780-81, a winter of deep snow, Greene and Cornwallis played hare and hound, feigning attacks, terrorizing the countryside, skirmishing in guerrilla-style hit-and-run probes. And you can see on the map here the back-and-forth trail of Greene along with Kosciusko and Hull. This way for a battle here, over here to 96, back here to Guilford Courthouse, down here again, Cowpens, Utah Springs. I haven't got all the tracing right. There's even more. But it was an extraordinary number of miles that were logged. And remember, Agrippa Hull would have been on foot. Kosciusko usually would have been on horse. In this cockpit of war, Kosciusko and Hull had many opportunities to witness the operation of plantation slavery in the South. Above all, they learned on a daily basis that Southern slaves were willing to pledge their lives for the British cause in exchange for freedom. And this, of course, went back to the proclamation in November 1775 from the Royal Governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, which promised freedom, lifelong freedom, to any slave or white indentured servant that reached the British lines. Wherever they went, in whatever the battle they found, the plantation slaves they saw fleeing in shoals to the British. There is the operative language. Declare all indebted servants, Negroes and others, free that are able and willing to bear arms, they joining His Majesty's troops. Here is Lord Dunmore. And this witnessing of enslaved blacks in the South became an important part of Kosciuszko's developing attitudes towards slavery and inspired him, I believe, to think about how America might be transformed in the scrum of war. For the last 15 years, here is one other battle that they were at, the Battle of Cowpens. And Ron Richardson talked about historical amnesia. Let me take a moment here. Try to find any mention in the history books of this 14-year-old bugler boy, now armed, taking dead aim at none other than Banaster Tarleton, the leader of the Green Dragoons, the quick strike force of the British, the most feared British general in the American Revolution. And Tarleton is about to strike down William Washington, not a familiar name, happens to be George Washington's cousin. If it weren't for the 14-year-old bugle boy, Washington's cousin would not have lived that day. We don't even know the name of the 14-year-old black boy. We do know that he was commemorated in this painting done many years later by an artist of the mid-19th century. For the last 15 years of the war, 15 months of the war, Kosciuszko and Hull, in the aftermath of the American-French victory at Yorktown, pushed eastward and southernward here to participate in the siege of Charleston, where the British had been lodged for several years. It was here that Kosciuszko volunteered to lead troops into the field again. And there they were a part of the victory celebration when they liberated Charleston from British rule. That done, they lingered in the city waiting word for the peace treaty in Paris to be signed. And then by ship, they made their way to Philadelphia. And that is the red dotted line I've traced here. Nathaniel Greene's wife was on the same ship with Agrippa Hull and Kosciuszko, and all the way up into the Delaware Bay and the Delaware River to Philadelphia. And they arrived just before the Continental Congress was ousted from the city in June 1783, when the soldiers of the Pennsylvania Line mutinied to get their back pay from the Continental Congress. Now, at that point, Kosciuszko decided to return to Poland, and he asked Agrippa Hull to return with him. Grippy declined. As a token of his affection, Kosciuszko gave him a flintlock pistol with the Polish gunmaker's name inlaid in gold on top of the barrel. Hull made his way north to New York from Philadelphia on foot. There he mustered out at West Point, where he'd served so many months with Kosciuszko on July 24, 1783. More than 120 miles of walking awaited him to return to Stockbridge in western Massachusetts. When he reached the Berkshire Hill town, there was really no one to sing the praises or write a word about the 6 years and 2 months that the black New Englander had served in the war. His was the silent story of the poor soldiers whose ability to withstand adversity was the secret ingredient that enabled Washington's outgunned, outprovisioned, and outtrained army to prevail against the British and their German and Indian auxiliaries. We have only a fragment to tell us of Hull's thought as he mustered out of the Continental Army, but it's a very special fragment. Stockbridge's first historian, Electa Jones, she knew Hull well, for many years wrote, "For Grippy, the war could not last too long." She was collecting oral testimony in the 1840s when Agrippa Hull was still alive. And I think what she was saying was that the obscure young black man from a backwater western Massachusetts village, through nearly 7 years of war, had been in day-to-day contact with two significant officers, John Patterson and Thaddeus Kosciuszko, both closely connected to Washington. And in the 7 years of war, Hull had found himself. And for the remainder of his long life, he replayed his revolutionary experiences with relish. From the even-tempered, humane, and reform-minded Kosciuszko, Hull had learned unconditional loyalty, an unswerving belief in the dignity of every individual, and dedication to a freer world. And from Hull, here we see a quiet black agency at work, I believe, Kosciuszko had developed a great respect for African Americans. Hardly the innately inferior creatures that Jefferson at this very time is writing about in his famous notes on the state of Virginia. Returning to Stockbridge, Hull faced less than rosy prospects. He found his mother blind and nearly helpless. Now Hull, almost 25 years old, had to find a way to support himself and his mother. He played what was really the only card in his hand. He found a place serving a person of prestige and power and patronage. And that is how he found himself in the service of Theodore Sedgwick, who was also the master of Elizabeth Freeman, Mumbet, who many of you probably know. And Mumbet had just gained her freedom through Sedgwick's intervention in a landmark slavery case before the Massachusetts Judicial Court. Hull and Mumbet would serve the Sedgwick family for almost two decades. And we could use Mumbet as another example of black agency, because she was the one who virtually mothered a brood of Sedgwick's children when his wife was in a state of psychiatric crisis. Now, Hull's servant position in the powerful Sedgwick family was important for him, but he did not rest on that notion of service to an important white man for very long. That's Catherine Sedgwick, who we'll hear about in a moment. This is a map of the village of Stockbridge taken in the 1840s, but it's important because it shows us just 18 months after Agrippa Hull reached Stockbridge, he purchased his first piece of land. That in itself was unusual for a young black man. And he chose the lot of land across the Housatonic River that you see winding just below the village of Stockbridge, where the arrow points, on Conkapod Brook, named for the Christianized Stockbridge Indian, Chief John Conkapod, who had died in 1766 after holding several town offices. It was only half an acre, but it was land of his own. And in fact, it was the half acre that used to, where King Conkapod's wigwam used to stand. And all the more important was that Hull had served in the same regiment with Abraham Conkapod, the son of Chief John Conkapod, in the Massachusetts line. Conkapod's son and Agrippa Hull had been at Valley Forge together. They'd been in Monmouth courthouse battle together and many other places. So this land purchase was very important. And it coincided with Hull's first marriage to Jane Darby. She, like Elizabeth Freeman, had fled an abusive master. And she, like Mumbet, had gained her freedom through Sedgwick's intervention. From Stockbridge, now fast-forwarding to the 1790s, Hull followed the travails of the Polish officer he had served so faithfully during the American Revolution. Kosciuszko, leaving the United States without Agrippa Hull, had convinced another African-American, known only to us as Negro John, to return to Europe with him in 1784. And there, John stayed at Kosciuszko's side for the next 12 years. These were the years when the Polish hero of the American Revolution emerged as the commander of the Polish forces that tried to drive the British the Russian occupiers from their homeland. And Kosciuszko became the leader of a reform movement to emancipate the nation's serfs. By reading Stockbridge's newspaper, Western Star, Agrippa could follow the Polish battles to throw off the Russian yoke. That is Kosciuszko on his horse, and on the right side, you'll see some of the serfs, many of them fighting only with pikes and scythes against Russian artillery, odds which could not be surmounted and ultimately led to defeat, but still made Kosciuszko one of the most revered heroes in Polish history. After a number of these battles, Kosciuszko himself was thrown off his horse, speared, left on the battlefield near dead, revived enough to land in St. Petersburg prison. And there he stayed for several years. Hull could follow all of this because it was reported in the Stockbridge newspapers. And he must have been excited to find out that Paul Czar I liberated or released Kosciuszko from prison, along with Negro John, who you can see on the left. Talk about historical amnesia. I don't know that we'll ever recover it in relation to Negro John, but it's remarkable that Kosciuszko had found this man to take to Poland with him. And when he was released from prison, the Warsaw Press recorded Kosciuszko's release, along with, in their words, his inseparable companion. Not his faithful servant. No, his inseparable companion for 12 years. So we are talking about a Polish man who for 16 years was never out of daily contact with an African American. And this, I think, is part of the black agency that I've been talking about. Negro John is part of it as well. Well, when Kosciuszko was sprung from prison, he went to Sweden, then England, and decided to return to America in 1797, there to renew war-forged friendships and to collect his revolutionary military pay that he had never received. He stayed only 9 years, 9 months, excuse me, in 1797 and 98, because he was fingered by the Federalist administration as a suspected supporter of the French Revolution and possibly even a French agent. So the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 were shaken under his nose, thus making it advisable for him to sneak out of the country. But he met several of his goals: to visit Revolutionary War friends, including Agrippa Hull, who went to New York City to meet his old Polish friend and officer, and also Kosciuszko wanted to secure his back pay, which now totaled more than $16,000. That would amount to several million today. No records survived indicate what Hull and Kosciuszko might have said in their meeting in New York City. But surely Kosciuszko told Hull about Negro John, who had left Kosciuszko in Stockholm, about Kosciuszko's attempt to bring freedom to Poland's serfs, about his ordeal in the Russian prisons. And for his part, we can imagine that Grippy Hull filled in Kosciuszko on his success in fitting into Stockbridge village life. And so then, all of this fed into an extraordinary decision that Kosciuszko made as he was about to leave America under the cloak of night in order to escape possible imprisonment under the Alien and Sedition Acts. The opportunity came from a close relationship that Kosciuszko had developed with Jefferson, the vice president of Adams, in Philadelphia in 1797 and 98. For a few brief months in the city where the nation's first abolition society was working actively to end slavery, Kosciuszko and Jefferson communed almost daily. The bond they forged was so close that Jefferson soon called Kosciuszko, quote, as pure a son of liberty as I have ever known, and of that liberty which is to go to all and not to the few or the rich alone. As he planned to leave the country in May 1798, Kosciusko, with Jefferson at his side, penned a will that stands as one of the most extraordinary and ignored documents of American history. Agrippa Hull figuratively stood in the shadow of Kosciusko as the Pole took up his pen and wrote these words: "I do hereby declare and direct that I authorize my friend Thomas Jefferson to employ the whole of my property in the United States," this is the $16,000, "in purchasing Negroes from among his own or any others, and giving them liberty in my name, and giving them an education in trades or otherwise, and in having them instructed for their new condition of freedom in the duties of morality, which may make them good neighbors, good fathers and mothers, husbands or wives, and in their duties as citizens, teaching them to be defenders of their liberty and country. That the children of bondage should become American black citizens of the likes of Agrippa Hull was the Polish hero's wish." And having signed the will, witnessed by Jefferson, and also by Jefferson's financial advisor in Philadelphia, having signed the will, Kosciusko fled by night to board a ship taking him back to Europe forever. If Kosciusko had died on the return passage to Europe, Jefferson would immediately have had the money to purchase the freedom of most of his slaves at Monticello, including his mistress, Sally Hemings, and several of her children that Jefferson had fathered. Kosciusko arrived in Paris in 1798 amid the swirling politics of the French Revolution, and there he tried to mount new attempts to drive the Russians from his revered homeland. But it was not to occur, for Napoleon's ascent to power dashed any such possibility, and Jefferson then, as president from 1801 to 1809, could do nothing to aid the Polish cause. After Napoleon met his fate at Waterloo, the Congress of Vienna refused in 1815 to restore Polish former sovereignty. Kosciusko retired sorrowfully to a village in the Alps in Switzerland for the last several years of his life, corresponding frequently with Jefferson and believing to the very end, when he died in 1817, that his American assets would free many, if not all, of Jefferson's slaves at Monticello. Though thoroughly frustrated in reconstituting Poland and in emancipating the serfs, which he tried to do, Kosciusko would have been gratified to know that Agrippa Hull had made a life for himself back in faraway Stockbridge. By the early 1800s, and here we're looking at a tax list of 1807, Agrippa Hull had purchased 15 more acres where he was living out Jefferson's ideal of a self-disciplined, civic-minded, and self-sustaining yeoman farmer, the very model of what Jefferson imagined was the future of America. When the tax assessor made the rounds — these are tax lists in Stockbridge today for almost every year of the first half of the 19th century — when he made the rounds, he saw that Hull's assessment — you see the line, the yellow line at the bottom of the page — put him ahead of 40% of the white Stockbridge landowners, and first among the 14 black taxable families. All around him, landlessness was becoming the unwelcome situation for an increasing percentage of white Massachusetts householders. But Hull was edging forward. He saved carefully. He enlarged his small farm, raising sheep, maintaining a horse and milk cows, cultivating an apple orchard. And to Grippy's delight, Elizabeth Freeman Mumbet became his immediate neighbor along what was called Negro Pond after she purchased land there in 1803, 1809, and 1811. This map was constructed showing Agrippa Hull's numerous land purchases, and Elizabeth Freeman's, by Lyon Miles, a historian, a local historian in Stockbridge, a stupendous job of searching the deeds in the Berkshire County Recorder's Office. And here, advancing himself, Agrippa Hull endeared himself to almost everyone in Stockbridge. While enlarging his farm, Agrippa continued to serve the Sedgwick family, but by the early 1800s, this relationship was wearing thin. They may not have known that Sedgwick was the author, as a member of the Congress, was the author of the Fugitive Aid Act of 1793. If they knew that, that would have displeased Mumbet and Grippy. It gave Southern slaveholders a virtual hunting license in pursuing runaway slaves fleeing to the North. But if they did not know that, an estrangement did occur a few years later. Many years later, in recording her childhood, Catherine Sedgwick remembered, quote, "My father's house was one of the few where the domestics were restricted to the kitchen table. Oh, said a woman to me, now Catherine, we are all made out of the same clay. We have got one maker and one judge, and we've got to lay down in the grave side by side, so why can't you sit down to the table together?" This is Catherine Sedgwick's recollection. But that was not to be when Sedgwick became a high Federalist in the late 1790s, and where the five black servants, Mumbet, Grippy Hull, and three others, ate around the kitchen fire. Developing a thorough distrust of the people, Catherine Sedgwick related, her father habitually spoke about ordinary folk as Jacobins, sans-culottes, and miscreants, unquote. And his daughter remembered further that her father, quote, dreaded every upward step that ordinary people made, regarding their elevation as a depression of the intelligence and virtue of the country. Well, surely Agrippa Hull was just such a person, elevating himself, pulling himself up by bootstraps. And Catherine said that she was taught the local saying of the Federalist Congregational minister, quote, "I don't say that every Democrat is a horse thief, but I do say that every horse thief is a Democrat." For Grippy, a man who had commanded the respect and affection of high-ranking officers in the Revolution, this probably rubbed hard against his sense of himself as a worthy, ordinary Stockbridge citizen. And so Grippy left the Sedgwick household, as did Mumbet, after Sedgwick ended his political career in 1800 with a paroxysm of conservative ranting. It was Grippy's special qualities that still made him a favorite, even after leaving the patronage of Theodore Sedgwick. Part of his success was perhaps that he did not elbow forward with a sharp-edged reformist agenda, which for most African Americans in the North was a dual affair, dissolving the racial discrimination that limited their striving forward for better lives and helping to end the nightmare of slavery that trapped their people generation after generation. Rather, Hull pushed his agenda quietly, sensitive, it seems, to the advantage of not rubbing too hard against stiff-necked New England Federalists, who even after the democratizing effects of the American Revolution and the Jeffersonian tide, still held considerable power in the Berkshire Hill towns. The local historian wrote this, "Grippy felt deeply the wrongs of his nation, but his feelings rose on the wings of prayer rather than burst from the muzzle of the musket." And yet Grippy made himself clear. In the summer of 1817, Hull's heart must have leaped upon hearing that Congress is debating an act to grant pensions to the surviving enlisted men of the Revolution. Kosciuszko, like all officers, had been awarded half pay for life, later commuted to 5 years of full pay. Enlisted men received nothing after the American Revolution. 34 years after mustering out, Grippy, at age 59, now received a monthly payment of $8. But that stipend was short-lived because the War Department, a year later, claiming too many fraudulent claims and cost overruns in the middle of the Depression of 1816-19, ordered courts to require an oath of poverty by any applicant. Dropped from the rolls, Hull waited another 8 years to see his pension restored. And then at that very time, he learned of Kosciuszko's death in the Swiss Alps. Newspapers around the country spread the word that the hero of two continents had succumbed to an epidemic of typhoid fever. Reporters told of mourners thronging the funeral procession led by children. At Kosciuszko's dying request, six poor peasants in the Swiss village carried the coffin. With American newspapers reporting Kosciuszko's final days and how all of Europe was saluting the Pole, Grippy's heavy heart must have found some solace in how the officer he had served maintained his humility and generosity to the downtrodden to his last breath. Well, after losing his pension, Agrippa Hull weathered the depression that followed the War of 1812, and he remained clear of debt while holding fast to his small farm. In 1822, he had remarried a second time. He was a widower. His first wife had died. He celebrated the marriage of his 26-year-old daughter to Morris Potter of Pittsfield, whose father was half Indian and half black. In another example of quiet activism, Hull and his wife, Peggy, adopted 6-year-old Mary Tilden, whose mother, Betty, toiling as a slave in New York, barely 5 miles across the Massachusetts border, fled to get her freedom and freedom for her little daughter. Mary's mother had reached Stockbridge, and it was in the Hull household that they took refuge. Peggy and Agrippa Hull hid her, as the record tells us, so that the officers couldn't find her and take her back to her master. And shortly, the Hulls adopted the infant Mary, just as New York's legislature finally put an end to slavery. And while sheltering escaped slaves, another part of his quiet black agency, Grippy learned from Stockbridge newspapers that Jefferson, in 1818, had refused to serve as the executor of Kosciuszko's will, as he had pledged in May of 1798. And the newspapers told in Stockbridge, as in many other newspapers, that Jefferson refused to take the American assets of the purest son of liberty he had ever known to free his slaves at Monticello, and that Jefferson then threw the probating of the will into the federal courts, where it would remain for many years. Hull could also read that a new executor of Kosciuszko's will tried to have the money used to establish a school where freed slaves could receive an education. It was to be called the Kosciuszko School in Newark, New Jersey. Polls down to the 1940s still believed that the Kosciuszko School was established in New Jersey, but it was not. We do not know Agrippa Hull's response after reading of how Kosciuszko's fondest dream of helping Jefferson blaze the way toward emancipating American slaves and educating them for the full rights of full citizens utterly dissolved. But one supposes that Hull must have grieved at Jefferson's betrayal. His heart must have fallen even more when the newspapers in Stockbridge, as elsewhere, reported after Jefferson's death in 1826 that 130 of his slaves, along with almost all the furnishings at Monticello, were put on the auction block to satisfy his creditors. If Jefferson had used Kosciuszko's assets, he could have pulled himself out of deep debt while also liberating most of his slaves. Let's reflect for a moment on what might have entered the history books as a poignant and corner-turning moment in history might have occurred. If Jefferson had honored his pledge to Kosciuszko to use the polls American military pay to free his slaves, would William Lloyd Garrison's statement be true when Garrison said, quote, "What an all-conquering influence must have attended Jefferson's illustrious example," if the author of the Declaration of Independence had acted on his much-repeated vow that the cancer of slavery should be and must be removed from the American body politic. And if this had been the case, if Jefferson had honored his pledge to Kosciuszko, perhaps we would see a statue of Agrippa Hull in Stockbridge, and perhaps one of Negro John, and elsewhere in America today to honor the two African Americans whose bravery and exemplary behavior figured so importantly in Kosciuszko's decision to fight for the abolition of serfdom in Poland and slavery's abolition in the United States. If Kosciuszko had lived until Jefferson's death, he would have been sorely disappointed with the man from Monticello he so admired, but he would not have been disappointed with his revolutionary compatriot, Agrippa Hull of Stockbridge. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the African American Studies Program at Boston University as part of the 200th anniversary of the ending of the U.S. Atlantic slave trade. Speaking on Agrippa Hull, New Perspectives on a Berkshire Revolutionary Patriot, was UCLA history professor Gary Nash. Professor Nash was introduced by Ronald Richardson, director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney with help from Michael Garth and Walter Dixon. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.